You are listening to a sermon by Don Tykrobe, recorded on Sunday, June 27, 2010, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Well, good morning. You never know when you speak in the summertime how many people are going to be here, so I think this is good.
This is summertime.
Well, maybe it's not summer. It's summertime somewhere. So as was alluded to a couple of times, one of the themes this morning is graduation, but I would say quite loosely. And the question, of course, is which came first? I was presented with the lectionary topic or the passages from the Bible, but I also knew we were going to be honoring the grads. So the topic naturally came to me, and part of that is because the left side of my brain just wants to organize things in a certain fashion so as to make sense for them and to put them into a meaningful order. And I also knew that we were going to be honoring the graduates, and it just seemed to make sense at this time of year to kind of put them together. Now, I've never given an address, say, at a graduation ceremony or been valedictorian, and I doubt it's going to happen at this point in my life. So I thought, well, this maybe is my opportunity. In the last 2 weeks, I've had the opportunity to attend two graduation ceremonies. As mentioned, Joel graduating first from Lord Byng High School, and then Aaron from Capilano University. And when I was reading through the lectionary text, there's a lot of, we've had them read this morning, and you can tell there's a lot of possibilities. It's very rich, the possibilities this morning. And I thought, well, maybe I can work them somehow into a theme on graduation. The problem, of course, is that for many of us, graduation does not necessarily resonate as much when we get older. Graduation is seen as a rite of passage for the young. We move on from high school to university, or we leave university and we enter the working world. For most of us, those days are long over. But graduation per se does not need to deal only with the big steps. I was intrigued with the origin of the words graduate and graduation, particularly when you consider the word gradual, which to me gives completely the opposite image. In fact, gradual, I looked it up, is defined as proceeding by degrees or by steps or degrees, moving or changing by fine or often imperceptible degrees. The key words here, of course, are steps and degrees. The word gradual was, in fact, originally a noun, and it was the response sung. It was the response song sung or recited between the epistle and the gospel in a medieval mass. The gradual was sung on the gradus, or steps of the altar from which it derived its name, as also did our words gradual, graduate, and graduation. They all, therefore, refer to steps in the journey through life, be they small and gradual or large and abrupt. In fact, we will see that many small steps often lead to one large step. First of all, I'm going to look at the transition of Elijah to heaven. This fits more closely our current usage of the word graduation. Nothing slow or imperceptible here. Rather, he graduates directly to heaven in a flaming chariot pulled by flaming horses in front of the eyes of his successor, Elisha. As mentioned by Veronica, this is a well-known story, and certainly no children's Bible is complete without a dramatic depiction of the scene. In the image in our mind's eye, we see heaven opening to accept Elijah and his flaming chariot, while on earth remain the astounded onlookers, mouths agape. But what I see here in the story is very simply retirement planning. Elijah did not have any retirement plans. That is the problem faced by many. With retiring, there's often nothing gradual. You work, and then one day you don't. You're retired. This often causes anxiety and uncertainty. Perhaps the most dramatic examples come from the world of sports, where declining skills necessitate the need to quit the game that for most they have played all of their lives, beginning as young children. A few years ago, Scott Niedermayer, arguably the greatest hockey player ever born in British Columbia, retired after winning the Stanley Cup with Anaheim. But halfway through the next season, he unretired. And he just recently captained the Canadian men's hockey team to the Olympic gold medal. And this past week, he retired again. My father retired in his 60s, and after some 30 years working with the same engineering firm, the company gave him a party, sent him and my mom on a cruise, and when they got back, he went back to work. He didn't know what to do with himself, as over the years, his identity had become so wrapped up in his job that he needed to go back. Eventually, after a few more years, he did retire for good. Elijah is considered to be one of the major Old Testament prophets. Throughout his life, he stands heroically and often alone against King Ahab, Queen Jezebel, and the worshippers of Baal. His stature is such that in New Testament times, his name is suggested when Jesus asks his disciples, who does he think he is? He appears with Jesus alongside Moses on the mount at the time of the Transfiguration. As far as prophets go, Elijah is on the top of his game. But how do you retire from such a lofty position? Well, you don't. The biblical stories do not usually have a happy ending for prophets, whose targets are the rich and powerful of their day. And yet, it was time for Elijah's ministry to come to an end. Elisha was in the wings, relatively young and groomed by God, ready to take over and to continue the work. And then, in perhaps the most dramatic retirement scene ever, Elijah is gone. The event witnessed by Elisha, and because of this, Elisha was deemed by the people to be his worthy successor. Perhaps there was no other way that Elijah would ever have retired, even though this was necessary as his mission on earth was fulfilled, and it was time, and it was left to others chosen by God to continue the work. Moving on to the Luke passage. The story we come to in Luke is quite the contrast and perhaps more definitely fits the word gradual. Jesus is now on his way to the cross. In Luke 9, verse 51, we read, "As the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. And he sent messengers on ahead who went into a Samaritan village to get things ready for him. But the people there did not welcome him because he was heading for Jerusalem." This is the official launch. Jesus is now on his journey to the cross. In the book of Luke, this is the first time that it is stated clearly that Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem. Throughout the book of Luke, the subtle narrative continues. In Luke 17, it says, "Now on his way to Jerusalem, Jesus traveled along the border between Samaria and Galilee." And in Luke 18, it says, Jesus took the 12 aside and told them, "We are going to Jerusalem, and everything that is written by the prophets about the Son of Man will be fulfilled." And then again in Luke 19, it says, "While they were listening to this, he went on to tell them a parable, because he was near Jerusalem. And the people thought that the kingdom of God was going to appear at once." After Jesus had said this, he went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. This is labeled in my Bible as, under the caption, Sunday, the start of the Passion Week. We know the end result, but the process here is one of gradually getting nearer the ultimate destination of Jerusalem. Slowly, inexorably, inevitably, fully aware of the consequences, Jesus travels on with the disciples in gradual steps towards his ultimate goal. The second part of the Luke passage is about counting the cost, and this is a song very appropriately chosen by Rosie. And I would add to that, that time is of the essence. Jesus says that the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head, implying that the cost of following him is very high. Jesus was upfront, and he was very clear. If you want to follow me, you had better understand that the cost will be high. Are we personally prepared for the cost of church membership in terms of our time and our resources? Are we clear with new members what the cost will be, or is rather church growth paramount? The young man says he will follow Christ once he buries his father. Now, we should be clear here that his father is probably still alive. In fact, he's probably in excellent health. What the young man is saying is that I will follow you sometime in the future when my other obligations are complete. Just not right now, because other things, frankly, in my life are more important. But Jesus says to him that the kingdom is too important and too valuable and that it cannot wait. You must act now. We all know through personal experience that the longer something is put off, the less likely it is ever to be done. Elsewhere in the Gospels, we are presented with stories dealing with matters of great urgency and great value. The parable of the hidden treasure and the pearl from Matthew 13. The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it again, and then in his joy went and sold all he had, and he bought that field. And in verse 45, again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. When he found one of great value, he went away and sold everything he had, and he bought it. The urgency and the value are there. In his 2008 best-selling book, Outliers, Malcolm Gladwell argues that one needs to spend approximately 10,000 hours to be good at something or to be an expert in a matter. 10,000 hours. To put this into perspective, I am currently trying to learn Spanish, and I make a consistent effort to put at least an hour every single day into the effort. So at that pace, according to Malcolm Gladwell, it will take me 27 years to become an expert. Now, if I want to be an expert in 5 years, I need to spend 5.5 hours per day, every day. If I want to become an expert in a year, it will take me 27 hours per day. But even that is not enough. The mantra today for professionals is continuing education. We commit the time and energy in obtaining a professional degree, such as accounting, the law, architecture. But then we must keep ourselves up to date. For most professional associations, this has become institutionalized in that members must report back every year that they have achieved the minimum number of prescribed development hours. This is not even touching on those who practice in the areas, for instance, of, say, taxation, where the required knowledge changes on a daily basis, or computers, where it seems to change on an hourly basis. The effort required for something that is worthwhile can be huge. And this cost, Jesus says, should be considered at the outset. So having a goal, looking on ahead towards Jerusalem. Having set the goal and having counted the cost, you must look ahead. The Luke passage says that once you have taken up the plow, you cannot look back, or you are not fit for the kingdom. And the reason for this is that if you look back, the furrow will not be straight. I love to windsurf, and I love to teach others to windsurf. I find that a common tendency in those that who are learning is that as the sail captures the wind and they start to move over the water, they immediately look down at their feet to see what's going on. And this is not good. Without a clear view out to the horizon, the sailor is at the mercy of the wind and the waves. If you look down when you walk, you risk bumping into people or things. If you're in a canoe and looking down, you simply move aimlessly. Looking down when you are involved in sports requiring balance is worse, because looking down makes it impossible to maintain your balance. You fall over and you go nowhere. So the first rule is look up. Look out to the horizon and choose a spot where you want to go. Where you set your sight and where you focus on, that is where you go. This is particularly important as we get older, as it is not helpful to go forward by continually looking back. The story is told of a man who takes his grandson with him to the beach. At the end of a long day, the man meets an old friend and stops to chat. The friend complains bitterly about growing older and all his problems, and to top it all off, he has a bit of sunstroke. The boy has been listening to the grumbling, but maybe he didn't understand quite right, because when they're leaving, he said, "Opa, I know that you're old too, but I hope you never suffer from a sunset." In the Galatians 5 passage, it enumerates the positive and the negative, the flesh and the spirit, the vices and the virtues. And I'll read them again, starting in verse 19. And I'm reading from a slightly different version. "What the sinful nature does is clear. It enjoys sexual sins, impure acts, and wild living. It worships statues of gods. It also worships evil powers. It is full of hatred and fighting. It is full of jealousy and fits of anger. It is interested only in getting ahead. It stirs up trouble. It separates people into their own little groups. It wants what others have. It gets drunk and takes part in wild parties. It does many things of that kind. I warn you now, as I did before, people who live like this will not receive God's kingdom." And then in verse 22, "But the fruit the Holy Spirit produces is love, joy, and peace. It is being patient, kind, and good. It is being faithful and gentle and having control of oneself. There is no law against that kind of thing." Over the centuries, the emphasis of the church has often swung from one end to the other. On the one hand, we have movements such as the Crusades and the Inquisitions in its many forms, which focused on the negative aspects of our faith. At one time, the stated goal of the Spanish Inquisition was to root out and suppress heretics, idolaters, blasphemers, Lutherans, and Jews. I would include as well some of the revival movements, which, although effective, placed a heavy emphasis on the catalog of sins and thou shalt not. The flip side has been many utopian movements, which have tried to isolate themselves from all societal contact and therefore remain pure to the virtues. But where do we focus our attention? The story is told of olden days when a weary traveler approaches the gates to a city. An old man is sitting by the gates watching people come and go. The traveler approaches him and asks, "Old man, tell me, you sit here all day long. What are the people of this city like?" And the old man replies, "What were the people like in the city you were from?" To which the traveler answers, "They are mean, arrogant, uncharitable, and they think only of themselves." The old man smiled sadly and advised the traveler to keep traveling, because the people in this city were exactly the same. Later that same day, another traveler approaches the old man and asks him, "Old man, tell me, you sit here all day long. What are the people of this city like?" And the old man replies, "What were the people like in the city you were from?" To which the traveler answers, "They are kind, friendly, charitable to all, even to strangers like myself." The old man smiles and says to the traveler, "Then enter through the city gates, because you will find the people of this city are exactly the same." I find a similar answer in today's text, starting with Galatians 5. The whole law can be found in a single command: love your neighbor as you love yourself. I will come back to this thought in a somewhat roundabout way. As I mentioned earlier, the Old and the New Testament readings are interesting because of the many parallels found between Jesus and Elisha. In Luke 9, verse 7, it says, "Now Herod the Tetrarch heard about all that was going on, and he was perplexed, because some were saying that John had been raised from the dead, and others that Elijah had appeared, and still others that one of the prophets of long ago had come to life." And in verse 18, Once when Jesus was praying in private and his disciples were with him, he asked them, "What do the crowd say I am?" And they replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah." And in verse 29, "As he was praying, the appearance of his face changed, and his clothes became as bright as flash of lightning. Two men, Moses and Elijah, appeared in glorious splendor, talking with Jesus. They spoke about his departure, which he was about to bring to fulfillment at Jerusalem." Again, the slow and steady journey to Jerusalem. previously, when I mentioned the beginning of the journey to the cross, I read in Luke 9, starting at 51. As the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem, and he sent messengers on ahead who went into a Samaritan village to get things ready for him. But the people there did not welcome him because he was heading for Jerusalem. When I read that before, I left out the next verse, which says, "The disciples James and John saw this. They asked, 'Lord, do you want to call down fire from heaven to destroy them?'" Wow. Where did this come from? If we return to the Elijah story, but go back one chapter to the first chapter of 2 Kings, it says, "Then the king sent to Elijah a captain with his company of 50 men. The captain went up to Elijah, who was sitting on the hill, and said to him, 'Man of God, the king says, come down.' And Elijah answered the captain, 'If I am a man of God, may fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50 men.' Then fell from heaven and consumed the captain and his men. The king sends another 50 men, and the same thing happens. Only when the third captain appears with his 50 men and pleads for their lives are they spared. So the disciples, James and John, they see the historical parallels between Jesus and Elijah. And they are not happy with the treatment they received. They ask Jesus to rain righteous fire like in olden days upon a Samaritan town. And how does Jesus respond? He responds in two ways. First, he says to them, "Don't do it. That is not what my ministry is about. You do not know what kind of spirit you are of, for the Son of God did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them." But he also answers in a more fundamental way. Although not included in the lectionary readings, he gives his answer in Luke chapter 10. A lawyer is talking with Jesus and asks what he must do to have eternal life. Jesus turns this around and makes the lawyer answer, who says in verse 27, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. Love him with all your strength and with all your mind. And love your neighbor as you love yourself." Jesus commends him on his answer, but the lawyer goes on to ask, "But who exactly is my neighbor?" Jesus replies at the end of chapter 10 with the definition of who one neighbor is. And wouldn't you know it, the neighbors are those very same Samaritans, as Jesus instructs the people by the way of the parable of the Good Samaritan. So we went full circle from the disciples wanting to rain fire down upon the town where they were not welcome, to Jesus using those exact people as his definition of who the neighbor is that you must love. So then how do I summarize these texts and relate them back to graduation, which seems like a long time ago? Again, very loosely, life is filled with many gradual steps which culminate in big steps. Count the cost as you move diligently forward through life. But having done so, look ahead, not behind. And focus on the positive, not the negative.